My countrymen, no one can contemplate current conditions without finding much that is satisfying and still more that is encouraging. Our country is leading the world in the general readjustment to the results of the great conflict. Many of its burdens will bear heavily upon us for years, and the secondary and indirect effects we must expect to experience for some time. But we are beginning to comprehend more definitely what course should be pursued, what remedies ought to be applied, what actions should be taken for our deliverance, and are clearly manifesting a determined will, faithfully and conscientiously, to adopt these methods of relief. Already we have sufficiently rearranged our domestic affairs so that confidence has returned, business has revived, and we appear to be entering upon an era of prosperity which is gradually reaching into every part of the nation. Realizing that we cannot live unto ourselves alone, we have contributed of our resources and our counsel to the relief of the suffering and the settlement of the disputes among the European nations. Because of what America is and what America has done, a firmer courage, a higher hope inspires the heart of all humanity. It will be well not to be too much disturbed by the thought of either isolation or entanglement, of pacifists or militarists. The physical configuration of the earth has separated us from all of the old world, but the common brotherhood of man, the highest law of our being, has united us by inseparable bonds with all humanity. Our country represents nothing but peaceful intentions toward all the earth. But it ought not to fail to maintain such a military force as comports with the dignity and security of a great people. It ought to be a balanced force, capable of defense by sea and land, beneath the surface and in the air. But it should be so conducted that all the world may see in it not a menace, but an instrument of security and peace. This nation believes thoroughly in an honorable peace, under which the rights of its citizens are to be everywhere protected. It has never found that the necessary enjoyment of such a peace could be maintained only by a great and threatening array of arms. In common with other nations, it is now more determined than ever to promote peace through friendliness and goodwill, through mutual understanding and mutual forbearance. We have never practiced the policy of competitive armaments. We have recently committed ourselves, by covenants with the other great nations, to a limitation of our sea power. As one result of this, our Navy ranks larger in comparison than it ever did before. Removing the burden of expense and jealousy which must always accrue from keen rivalry, is one of the most effective methods of diminishing that unreasonable hysteria and misunderstanding which are the most potent means of fomenting war. This policy represents a new departure in the world. It is a thought, an ideal, which has led to an entirely new line of action. It will not be easy to maintain. Some never move from their old position. Some are constantly slipping back to the old ways of thought and the old action of seizing a musket and relying on force. Our private citizens have advanced large sums of money to assist in the necessary financing and relief of the old world. We have not failed, nor shall we fail to respond whenever necessary to mitigate human suffering and assist in the rehabilitation of distressed nations. These two are requirements which must be met by reason of our vast powers and the place we hold in the world. Some of the best thought of mankind has long been seeking for a formula for permanent peace. Undoubtedly, the clarification of the principles of international law would be helpful, and the efforts of scholars to prepare such a work for adoption by the various nations should have our sympathy and support. Much may be hoped from the earnest studies of those who advocate the outlawing of aggressive war. But all these plans and preparations, these treaties and covenants, will not of themselves be adequate. One of the greatest dangers to peace lies in the economic pressure to which people find themselves subjected. One of the most practical things to be done in the world is to seek arrangements under which such pressure may be removed, so that opportunity may be renewed and hope may be revived. There must be some assurance that effort and endeavor will be followed by success and prosperity. In the making and financing of such adjustments, there is not only an opportunity, but a real duty for America to respond with her counsel and her resources. Conditions must be provided under which people can make a living and work out of their difficulties. But there is another element, more important than all, without which there cannot be the slightest hope of a permanent peace. That element lies in the heart of humanity. Unless the desire for peace be cherished by us, unless this fundamental and only natural source of brotherly love be cultivated to its highest degree, all artificial efforts will be in vain. Peace will come when there's a realization that only under a reign of law based on righteousness, supported by the religious conviction of the brotherhood of man, can there be any hope of a complete and satisfying life. Parchment will fail. The sword will fail. It is only the spiritual nature of man that can be triumphant. There's no salvation in a narrow and bigoted partisanship. But if there is to be responsible party government, The party label must be something more than a mere device for securing office. Unless those who are elected under the same party designation are willing to assume party responsibility and exhibit sufficient loyalty and coherence so that they can cooperate with each other in the support of the broad general principles of the party platform, the election is merely a mockery. No decision is made at the polls, and there is no representation of the popular will. Common honesty and good faith with the people who support a party at the polls require that party, when it enters office, to assume control of that portion of the government to which it has been elected. Any other course is bad faith and a violation of the party pledges. When the country has bestowed its confidence upon a party by making it a majority in the Congress, it has a right to expect such unity of action as will make the party majority an effective instrument of government. This administration has come into power with a very clear and definite mandate from the people. The expression of the popular will in favor of maintaining our constitutional guarantees was overwhelming and decisive. There was a manifestation of such faith in the integrity of the courts that we can consider that issue rejected for some time to come. Likewise, the policy of public ownership of railroads and certain electric utilities met with unmistakable defeat. The people declared that they wanted their rights to have not a political but a judicial determination, and their independence and freedom continued and supported by having the ownership and control of their property not in the government but in their own hands. As they always do when they have a fair chance, the people demonstrated that they are sound and determined to have a sound government. When we turn from what was rejected to inquire what was accepted, they ought not to be burdened with a great array of public employees. They are not required to make any contribution to government expenditures except that which they voluntarily assess upon themselves through the action of their own representatives. Whenever taxes become burdensome, remedy can be applied by the people. But if they do not act for themselves, no one can be very successful in acting for them. The time is arriving when we can have further tax reduction, when, unless we wish to hamper the people in their right to earn a living, we must have tax reform. The method of raising revenue ought not to impede the transaction of business. It ought to encourage it. I am opposed to extremely high rates because they produce little or no revenue, because they are bad for the country, and finally, because they are wrong. We cannot finance the country. We cannot improve social conditions through any system of injustice, even though we attempt to inflict it upon the rich. Those who suffer the most harm will be the poor. This country believes in prosperity. It is absurd to suppose that it is envious of those who are already prosperous. The wise and correct course to follow in taxation and all other economic legislation is not to destroy those who have already secured success, but to create conditions under which everyone will have a better chance to be more successful. The verdict of the country has been given on this question. That verdict stands. We shall do well if we heed it. These questions involve moral issues. We need not concern ourselves much about the rights of property if we will faithfully observe the rights of persons. Under our institutions, those rights are supreme. It is not property, but the right to hold property, both great and small, which our Constitution guarantees. All owners of property are charged with a service. The rights and duties of these have been revealed through the conscience of society to have a divine sanction. The very stability of our society rests upon production and conservation. For individuals or for governments to waste and squander their resources is to deny these rights and disregard these obligations. Under a despotism, the law may be imposed upon the subject. He has no voice in its making, no influence in its administration, does not represent him. Under a free government, the citizen makes his own laws, chooses his own administrators, which do represent him. Those who want their rights respected under the Constitution and the law ought to set the example themselves of observing the Constitution and the law. While there may be those of high intelligence who violate the law at times, barbarian and the defective always violate it. Those who disregard the rules of society are not exhibiting a superior intelligence, are not promoting freedom and independence, are not following the path of civilization, but are displaying the traits of ignorance, of servitude, of savagery, and treading the way that leads back to the jungle. The essence of a republic is representative government. Our Congress represents the people and the states. In all legislative affairs, it is the natural collaborator with the president. In spite of all the criticism which often falls to its lot, I do not hesitate to say that there is no more independent or effective legislative body in the world. It is, and should be, jealous of its prerogative. I welcome its cooperation and expect to share with it not only the responsibility but the credit for our common effort to secure beneficial legislation. These are some of the principles which America represents. We have not by any means put them fully in practice, but we have strongly signified our belief in them. The encouraging feature of our country is not that it has reached its destination, but that it has overwhelmingly expressed its determination to proceed in the right direction. It is true that we could, with profit, be less sectional and more national in our thought. It would be well if we could replace much that's only a false and ignorant prejudice with a true and enlightened pride of race. But the last election showed that appeals to class and nationality had little effect. Built on blood and force. No ambition, no temptation lures her to thought of foreign dominions. The legions which she sends forth are armed not with the sword, but with the cross. The higher state to which she seeks the allegiance of all mankind is not of human, but of divine origin. She cherishes no purpose save to merit the favor of Almighty God.